Hello, cinephiles, and welcome to Indie Outlook, the show that sheds light on must-see cinema from the Windy City and around the globe. I'm your host, Matt Fagerholm of HollywoodChicago.com. My guest today is Matt Sheehan of HollywoodSnitch.com. Welcome to the show, Matt.
Yes, good to be back once again.
That's right. And at the very top of the show, we're going to talk about a film that I wouldn't classify as indie per se, but it's going to segue into a larger topic, which is the incredible cinematographer Roger Deakins, who, if you're into film and you're into cinematography, into brilliantly lensed imagery, you know this man. He's a giant among giants. And his latest film is the new James Bond film, Skyfall, which I saw. And, I mean, people are going nuts over this thing. They are just going crazy. They're saying this is the best Bond ever. We're getting just huge. And, you know, I'm not a big Bond fan. I'm not someone who has to see every Bond. You know, I don't feel like there's really a lot to learn about masculinity from him unless you happen to be an action figure. I don't know. But, you know, he's a fun guy to watch. You know, everyone wants to dream to be that kind of guy who can just jump off a speeding locomotive and just be totally
and into
fine,
bed with some beautiful woman.
Exactly.
You know. Yeah.
You know,
and so. I agree. You know, it's I will admit that I have not seen every Bond movie. I can compare it to what I have seen. The one that I grew up with the most was Never Say Never Again, and of course that's not even an official one, because
sure,
it was always on WGN Channel 9 Sunday or Saturday afternoons all the time.
And who was the actor in that?
That was Connery.
That was Connery, okay.
But it wasn't produced by EN Productions, so it's not considered an official one. It's technically a remake of Thunderball.
Oh, okay.
But that's the one that I grew up on, but I have seen Goldfinger. I have seen Spy Who Loved Me. I've seen obviously the Brosnan ones. I have seen, I'm trying to think of some of the other ones. It's pretty much bits and pieces that I have seen.
Yeah.
And I feel ashamed to say that, considering that I am have become such a big fan of Daniel Craig as Bond, and I was a supporter of his, when he was chosen, and
okay,
there was all that.
When there was a huge hubbub about, you can't, yes, cast this guy, he doesn't look
too
like
blonde,
who he,
too short,
too blonde, even though apparently
eyes.
He is blonde in the novels. That he's a closer look to Bond than any of the other actors.
So. And not just but especially with, say, these ones, and with Skyfall, I think they've really given what I think Ian Fleming, the author of the Bond movies, really wanted, something that the really tortured soul.
Mm-hmm.
Really just, you know, he's an orphan. I mean, the thing with Skyfall and what's so great about it is it gives us as much of an origin story as we've seen so far with Bond. I don't want to say that we'll ever see, because I think with the continuation of Daniel Craig as Bond, they keep peeling off those layers, and I think right now this is the thickest layer that has been peeled off to really show the most about him. I think it really humanizes him. It takes away that superhero element and show that he's just like you and I.
And yet he is a superhero. I mean, as much as he is in any of the others, at least in like the first act or first, you know, whatever. I mean, at least in the first opening sequence where, mm-hmm, we see Bond do these superhuman things. But then once he's knocked down, literally.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
I mean, it's sort of is the catalyst to sort of open up more layers to his character. And then that's the question. Is this limiting Bond? Is this right for Bond to have him humanized, or is this something that feels like an intrusion on Bond, or does this enhance it? I'm still kind of on the fence ultimately on what this does to the character.
Well, I think it does, you know, it shows that he can have flaws. He's vulnerable, especially in this one. He's extremely vulnerable. There's the one line when he finally meets Javier Bardem's great Bond villain, I think, is really, and I do want to say on record and put this on tape, that leave it to Sam Mendes, the director of American Beauty, who also directed Skyfall, leave it to the director of American Beauty to give our tortured, torn, confused protagonist an equal and opposite antagonist who may or may not have the hots for him.
Yeah.
You know,
leave it
to the director of American Beauty for that. But but that
he's definitely schooled in the art of carnality in the cinema.
But that conversation where he goes, you know, Bond says everybody has to have a hobby, and Silva, Bardem's character, goes, "What's yours?" Resurrection. And to me, resurrection is not just about coming back to life, but it's a certain level of atonement too. Like, this is my second chance.
Hmm.
I need to make, you know, and I need to make up for what I have done wrong. And it, again, it brings us back to the humanizing that we're all humans. We can always make mistakes, and I think that really, it even puts it in this realistic perspective. And you know, we saw in Casino Royale. To be honest, I think Quantum of Solace can kind of just be erased. Yeah. There were a lot of issues going on. You had the writer's strike.
That's right. They didn't know what the whole story was as they were filming it. So yeah. There is that disorganized, or it's very like incoherent. The plot is just sort of all over the map. So.
And you really can't blame it for that because they still tried to put it. I don't think it's a bad movie. I just think that because of that fall from the comparison factor from Casino Royale down to Quantum of Solace, that's what keeps it at back. Mm-hmm. But with Casino Royale, it put it in this nice little post 9/11 world. You start to see that hints of what Skyfall really delves into.
Yeah, here's a Bond who doesn't care about if it's shaken or stirred.
Yeah,
or
and
like
I
that.
And I think it's also the story that is created for Skyfall for Bond, and I also wanted to note too is that as much of this is a James Bond film, and you and I were discussing this before, this is also an M movie. This is as much about Judi Dench's character, and she gets a lot of meaty parts to really work with in this. But I think with the story that they do, it almost mirrors the ups and downs of the entire franchise. Mm-hmm. You know, all these questions that they're asking of Bond, the character, as if it was real, basically the Cold War's over. We've got all this technology to work with us. Why do we need, you know, you running around wasting money to just try and, you know, capture a little disc or something or a hard drive or whatnot? And in a way, you know, it's like, are you relevant now is the question that can sort of ask.
And then it's also in the bigger picture, too, with the franchise. Is the franchise still relevant? How do we keep it relevant, you know?
Especially in these times now. And it really does because, you know, Bond was created and sort of centered in around the Cold War. It was, you know, but there's only so many, you know, nuclear missiles that can be stolen and gold and, you know, wealth can be, you know, thieved upon. So this really, it really puts it in this new perspective of cyber terrorism because that's a real, real problem that's going on and that's a real crime that is really damaging.
And I think even Roger Ebert mentioned a parallel to like Julian Assange or like WikiLeaks in relation to the Javier Bardem villain, where it's someone who's doing all the cyber terrorism. And okay, I have to say, the opening shot of Bardem, it's just this wonderful long take of just this figure walking out of an elevator, and the camera just never cuts. And it's just the closer Bardem comes to the camera, the more freaky he looks. I think he even does like a little like a Hannibal Lecter thing where he does the thing with his teeth like he's a rat or something like that, which I love that he talks about a whole monologue about rats, and then later you see him chasing Bond in the sewer like he's a rat.
Yeah.
And Deakins just holds that camera right on him. And I mean, there's no one better to just evoke, just to capture the creepiness of Bardem than Roger Deakins, because he also did No Country for Old Men.
Yeah. Two movies where Bardem is playing the bad guy with a bad hairdo.
Terrible, atrocious.
But it's you were talking about that introduction, the introduction shot of Silva, Bardem's character, but you also got to think that initial shot when Bond walks out, you get that trumpet of that drawn Barry.
Just one little cue. It's like a half cue of the original Bond theme.
And then he just walks into view, and then he walks to it, and it's that similar thing, and I think that really testifies to, again, I think it's one of the best-looking Bond films.
It might be the best. I mean, can you think of anything that compares? I mean, in just in terms of look? I think it's just because Deakins has such an artistic eye. He brings out so much, and he can navigate the genres. There's really like a few genres at play here, and I think like the last act of Skyfall is like a Western base, and he lenses it like a Western. And I think you can see some of Deakins' influences, or some other films that he's done, have sort of like helped him evoke the certain like complex genre mashing that this film does.
Yeah, when they did the opening title sequence, which is a great title sequence, I think.
And that's one of my favorite. I mean, whenever I see a Bond movie, that's always one of the things I look forward to, even though I'm not a Bond fan. I love the opening titles, and this is in that great classic tradition of titles.
And I'm not a fan of Adele. I kind of grew sick and tired of the fact that she's overplayed. And when I first heard, like, oh, she's doing it, really? But then you listen to it and you go, you think Shirley Bassey right away.
And that's why. They want to find someone to evoke that sound.
And if she does another one, like, and if they do pull a Shirley Bassey and have her do more than one, I will be perfectly content because I think she really nailed it. I think this is one of the best Bond themes, too. But after that scene, you know, I recognize, I'm like, oh, wait, Roger Deakins filmed this. This is going to be great. But then as it's going around, I'm thinking, things are looking a little too stylized, a little too forced in that regard. But
there were a couple effects. Yeah. I will say, in the opening chase, before it gets to the train, and the train is wonderful, and it's just great when it's on the train. But I think when he's like on the motorcycle or something, you can tell that there are faces digitally grafted onto the actors. At least I could tell. I mean, there are certain things that definitely stand out in the very opening.
That was something I wrote down in my notes, too, is that I think with the CGI, it was overdone. I think it's peppered throughout the movie, too. But then there's the scene in the, was it the China or Japan, the high-rise with the... he's trying to foil an assassin or something.
Yes, and you see all these wonderful, all the lights and the
lights
like
and
Vegas,
the glass and everything.
Yeah, it's like a Tokyo sort of thing.
Yeah, all the it's your, 20, 30 floors up, and it's that huge vertical advertisement reflecting off the glass. It's just so beautiful. I mean, really just stunning to look at.
And it emphasizes the silhouettes. So it's like we're looking at the fight, but in like an abstract way.
and then when he goes to the little casino part two, I think looks, it has those warm tones. Mm-hmm. And I think everything just plays beautifully.
And
I think he's
a master of warm tones, Deacon. Yeah. I mean, if you look back at, this movie I didn't really care too much about. In Time, I think, was one that he did with Justin Timberlake, where it's like he's, they have to like buy time, like time is the currency. And there is some wonderful scenes, wonderfully shot scenes, where Timberlake goes to meet like the rich, 1% of the society. And the people literally look like they're made of gold.
Yeah.
Just that it's so warm. It's like he just gets like a glimmer off of the skin.
And he's certainly the that's the highlight of the film. And I think, the score is good. I like, it's Thomas Newman, which is,
which is Mendez's, close collaborator.
But it had been, David Arnold for so long through several different directors, I think dating back to, I know he did GoldenEye pretty much. I think he did GoldenEye all the way through. I do not know if he did anything before, but he worked with, he was scoring the Olympics, which ironically enough featured Bond come down with the Queen, which was a nice little.
Exactly.
But
no, Mr. Bond. But Newman gets at a more subtle emotional complex, that which I think is what this film is trying to get at, especially as it goes on. That I feel like Newman was kind of good for that decision. As the film, it becomes a different film in a way.
And I think the feel of the movie too is also that. And one thing I'll mention, you mentioned Hannibal Lecter a little bit with Silva. The other thing I got was, you also get a little bit of Heath Ledger's Joker, I think. You get a little bit of that,
And it's not as showy. When I heard those comparisons, like, wow, it's going to be Bardem chewing the scenery. And, there's a bit of that, but it's not quite as in-your-face as Ledger. He's more tortured than he is enjoying his torture.
Subdued flamboyance, in a way. And it really gets... In the bigger picture, compared to that, comparing him to, the whole movie has a very Christopher Nolan feel to it. Oh. It does have that, there's a certain inspiration that you could find in that with, say, Dark Knight. Some comparisons can be made.
Mm-hmm.
The way the camera moves, the colors, the tones, and of course that goes back to Roger Deakins, but just the motivations of the character, origins. Having to make certain life decisions.
You can see how Nolan's technique has really influenced many filmmakers, like many mainstream voices.
And I will throw that out there, and this, of course, would be for another, this would be a whole other discussion, but is a Christopher Nolan Bond film not too far away? And I know he's just finished Dark Knight Rises. He likes to take that long rest.
I'd like to see him not just go right into another franchise. It'd be nice to see him do some other interesting weird
doing
thing
an
out of his head.
Original some sort of because he did that with Inception. And to be honest,
and
I think Inception is actually his. Well, Prestige was based on a book.
Oh, okay, so, but it was at least him trying to do something a little.
But Inception, I think, is his masterpiece. But again, that's a discussion. I would love to see that. I know a lot of people would, and I think he and Craig, that would really, we were talking about origin stories and being able to see more of the character, the Bond, whether it be his childhood, growing up an orphan, or, no surprise, it's not a spoiler, but, Albert Finney is the game master who, ironically enough, I read, who was rumored to be asked for that cameo. And he has a connection to the Bond, and I will not say the name.
Oh, okay.
I mouthed it to Matt.
No, you can say it. Believe me, it's
okay,
fine.
Well,
you can
spoiler,
say it.
If you have not seen the movie and you do not know, I'll give you 1, 2, 3. There was talk that Sam Mendes was going to call Sean Connery to play that part.
See, and that's not a huge surprise to me because I'm always waiting for the Bond where you just get Dalton, you know, drinking a martini on the side.
Well, the one thing that I always thought was kind of funny is that if they just basically turn it into kind of like how they what they're doing with the Bourne movies in a way, what I got a feel for what the new Bourne with Jeremy Renner was going to be was that the Jason Bourne moniker was just a moniker. It doesn't matter who gets to fill it, and maybe just recognizing the Bond films that, yes, there have been past people that have been gotten the code name James Bond with the 007, and I always thought it would be funny if they're all in a mental ward saying, I'm James Bond! No, I'm James. And they're all, in, you know, Connery and Dalton and Roger Moore and, you know, straitjackets bouncing off the walls saying,
that
you know, I'm 007.
That would be hilarious.
And, you know, I just always thought, and then you'd get, like, you know, M just kind of going, yeah, we'll take that one. You know, so I
that'd be great.
One thing I also want to mention is that it was also bringing Q into the fold when Daniel Craig.
Sure.
Things which
yes.
I
Ben Whishaw is a wonderful choice. I've always liked him.
He gave me a little bit of a. It was a more. It was like a likable version of Jesse Eisenberg's Mark Zuckerberg.
Sure.
You know, like
sure.
subdued, but you don't want to slap him. You know, he kind of had that way about him. And
he's like a more aggressive C-3PO or something.
That's a good comparison. I like that comparison. Yeah. But I thought he was going to provide some nice 21st century banter with the whole technology thing.
Oh sure, and that's what they wanted. It's again making it relevant, making it relevant. And
I think Mendez. I don't sense too much direction from Mendez. I think he just sort of put what already were strong pieces together. And he does, you know, he executes it well, but I think it was more of the story, the characters, the performances that really drove this movie, and of course,
and really
the
way it looks. And I agree. Yes. I think the cinematography is the best thing in it. I think it totally is deserving of an Oscar. And this, and if it does get a nomination, it will be the 10th Academy Award nomination for Roger Deakins. And he's either going to win something soon or he's going to get the Lifetime Achievement Award because this guy's legacy is just phenomenal. Phenomenal.
You look at his stuff, I mean, dating back to. I mean, he's been doing stuff since 1975.
Yeah, he was doing documentaries in the 70s. He was traveling all over the world. And then he just started doing stuff. I think, like, in Britain, he was doing, like, Sid and Nancy, stuff like that.
Sid and Nancy, and then he ended up... then more mainstream stuff came in the early 90s. He did Air America.
Yes. Well, the first thing I ever saw of his, and I was amazed that he did this, was The Secret Garden, which I think I was, like, 8 years old when I saw that in the theater. And you just felt so consumed in this, like, shadowy mansion and... Once you're in that garden, it's so beautiful. And yet there's like a coldness to the beauty. Mm-hmm. It wasn't like he was just romanticizing it. Everything felt like a real place. Like you could actually go there and you could just get the smells of the place. I mean, it was just it's so evocative. Even back then, I was like, this man is a genius.
Yeah, and I think probably the first one that I saw on this list was probably Shawshank Redemption. And granted...
And that's the first reference point
seen,
for a lot of people.
Who hasn't seen Shawshank Redemption? Mm-hmm. And the other, I think that list is shorter than who has. And I myself, being a huge Frank Darabont fan, I've seen everything. I've got to interview him. I think he's incredibly gifted. I think I think what he started with The Walking Dead was great. There's just so much. But with that, I mean, he just got lucky. The pieces fell into that movie so well. And I think part of that was just with Deakins on there, able to capture that prison so well. Mm-hmm. The you know, we were talking about those warm tones that he's able to create. But in this, you could see something. It's almost washed out in a way in Shawshank Redemption because everything's so cold and dusty and just has been. It's been sitting in the dark for so long. He hasn't seen sunlight. But in a way. Has just still started to fade away like it has been sitting in the sun the whole time.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And, you know, there's this one shot of when Tim Robbins is talking to Morgan Freeman and he tells him about, you know, the place in Mexico.
Yeah.
There's the shot of, it's a long shot, not a huge, I'd say, full long shot
mm-hmm.
of Tim Robbins on the right of the screen sitting on the wall, on the ground against the wall, and Morgan Freeman enters in. And there's that just that beautiful, there's so much to that shot right there. Tim Robbins is up against the wall. He's right so close, right on the other side of that wall. His freedom, you know. And then, you know, his friend seems so far away at that point. There's just so much that he's able. I would love to see him actually direct a movie. Can you actually imagine him finally saying, I'm calling, you know, he'd do all the... He'd be the director of photography, be director. I mean, he would just have just everything.
Well, and as you say, you know, going back to Skyfall for just a second, is that, you know, Mendez, it seemed like he wasn't putting too much of his own fingerprints on the material, where he was allowing things to play out. And then when it gets to that final act, where you're, it's basically like a West, it feels like a Western at the end. It really feels like Deakins is the show. I mean, the way that he lenses, I mean, there's a shot of like a silhouette coming out of like a fireball, basically, where it's just, and all these long, huge, it's just so gorgeous. And I mean, Deakins, what he wanted to do back way at the very beginning before his career even started was painting. I mean, he wanted to be a painter. That was like his first love. And I feel like you just see that painterly eye in every composition. There were moments in Skyfall. I was like, when was the last Bond movie where I wanted to freeze the frame to study the composition? But there is that.
Well, I think one thing too, I don't think they filmed it using these cameras, but it is being shown in IMAX, which is, I think, some people are saying that this could be the first Bond film that reaches $1 billion. And, you know, part of it you can kind of say, well, it's kind of inflated, kind of like they say about 3D movies.
Sure.
It's playing in IMAX, but to be honest, is it worth it in IMAX? I haven't seen it in IMAX, but just by judging based on what I saw, it's going to be gorgeous.
So.
They didn't use the IMAX cameras, but I would, again, you know, I hate to jump back, but, you know, if Nolan does get involved, can you imagine him using the IMAX cameras? Let's say
that's the next step.
Wally Pfister being involved with that, too. That could be another great Bond film looking
for Bond
film.
That was the cinematographer.
Yes.
Yeah.
But Local Boy, too.
That's right. Yeah,
but, Pfister. I think with the one pair of guys that I think Deakins really has made a name for himself with are the Coen brothers.
And that's why I think of Deakins in an indie vein, even though Coens are now, I guess you can say they're mainstream. But I mean, they really started as like their own. They're out there doing their own thing.
They're creating
their own voice.
They're mainstream recognized indie cool in a way.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they can go back and do something for cheap if they wanted to. They probably won't because they've got so many stars that like to work with them. You know, Clooney. And Pitt worked with him twice.
I mean, Brad Pitt,
Billy Bob Thornton, I think, has done a couple. You know, you look at, you know, J.K. Simmons, obviously, constantly going back. I mean, anything, you know, they did what, Barton Fink first together, and then it just became Fargo, and then Big Lebowski, and Oh Brother, We're Out Thou. I mean, you want to talk
about... Well, and I think he also did, I think right after Barton Fink, I think he did the Hudsucker Proxy, too. I mean, Deakins shot for them. And I think it was just the first three Coen films were shot by Barry Sonnenfeld, who then became a director himself. And then they basically stayed with Deakins for the most, I think, throughout the rest of their career. And it's really shown how the Coens are masters at just going from one genre to the next, kind of recreating their voice each time. And that's it's allowed their collaborators like Deakins to kind of experiment in different genres, try different things. And I mean, if you look at his work in Fargo, I mean, that's one of those films where it's like you feel like the physical, you feel the cold coming off the screen, and those wonderful overhead shots of Macy just, you know, kind of walking dejected through the, you know, trying to get the ice off his car. I mean, just these huge long shots that are just so lovely. And then the warmth, and then you cut to the warmth of Frances McDormand in her house. And,
yeah.
You know.
Then, you know, Big Lebowski, the way that's shot, too. I mean, there's...
And that's big and broad. And that's just... I mean, he's going for comedy, and it's so funny, and it's just... You know, he allows, you know, the colors to tell the story.
I mean, and there's a lot of colors in that, too, because of the sort of, shall we say, you know, even though I am legitimately bohemian, but of that bohemian nature of what the dude has and his style, you know, man.
Yes.
You know,
and the big gaudy colors, that wonderful, you know, dream sequence where it's like a Busby Berkeley number, all the ladies with the bowling pins on their head. And he's going for that garish look, which is great.
I mean, he also did, I mean, like A Beautiful Mind. A lot of people knocked that movie, but I love that movie.
No, I do too.
And it looks good too. I mean, there's a lot of good stuff that close ups that really work with that, where I think in the hands of any other average sort of either beginner or just, you know, shall we say half-assed, if I can.
Sure.
somebody who just is basic and goes by the numbers.
Well, and it's subtle.
Something different.
Yeah, there's a real subtle technique he does in Beautiful Mind, because it's only after you've seen it a second time you see the certain things that are actually happening and the things that are happening in sort of a skewered mind. And he does that very brilliant. I mean, he kind of has some noir influences in some of the more distorted scenes.
I mean, lately he's just been doing so much more, a lot more mainstream stuff. You know, obviously... All the you know, he did Jarhead for Mendez.
That's right.
And he, you know, all the Coen stuff like No Country for Old Men, and then he did The Assassination of Jesse James by the Carl Rutherford. Two fantastically beautiful films.
In 1 year.
I know, and then he did Doubt, and then...
Well, I have to go to Jesse James for a second, because that was the film where I became an official Deakins fan, and I had loved all of his other stuff, but that film was just so... It just felt so epic. And just, I mean, there were certain lenses that he used where it's like you're almost looking at the world through like a snow globe almost. Like, I mean, there was a real interesting level of texture in some of those shots. And it just, I mean, that was just like his masterwork for me. I was so knocked out by his work.
An obvious choice, but there's the one shot where they all lay siege on the train and the steam blowing out, and Brad Pitt, Jesse James, walks through. It's such a simple choice to make, saying like that's the coolest shot, but it is. It's just so badass.
Yes, which is why it's good for Bond when he finds those great introductory shots. Yeah. He can make a character leave an impression through very simple means, but it's very exact.
But, I mean, it's just you look at so much. I mean, he's got Skyfall. He even did Into True Grit. I mean, he did. You want to talk? And what's funny is you were referencing the Western aspect, and you know, you look at all of the Lebowski movies. They're all basically influenced by
the
Coen
Westerns.
All the Coens have that Western influence to it in a way. You know, there's just so much about it that I think he's able to capture that. And I think with like No Country for Old Men, which was my favorite film of that year, everything about that, you know, the lack of sound, you know, music in that, and the use of not only natural sounds, but the natural scenes, the natural environment that they're filming in. And there's I think one shot of when Josh Brolin's character comes across the money that sort of starts all this, and he ends up, there's the super long shot of him walking up to that tree where the dead guy's sitting there with the bag of money. And that just walk, you just sit there and you go, it's like you're kind of sitting there on pins and needles because you're getting closer. It almost plays out like a horror movie too. You're sitting there going, don't do it, don't open that door or whatever. Yeah. Something about that. And, you know, there's a lot of great shots of, again, with like Bardem and that opening shot with him just in that background gets up, and just there's so much
and it's one of those films where you would think so much more of the film would take place like at night. You know, it's about a killer who's on the, you know, there's a lot of evil in the story, and yet there were so many scenes. Some of the most disturbing scenes were played out in broad daylight, and it's Deakins found a way to make, you know, evil exist in daylight and make it still so, you know, eerie. I mean, it was because it's like evil just exists among us. It's not hiding in the shadows. It's right there in the nice little suburb, you know, at the end.
And in a way, it's evil can sort of go anywhere. You know, it's that's the whole message of the movie, is just like times are changed. Tommy Lee Jones' character can't understand certain criminal acts he's reading in the newspaper. No Country for Old Men, I absolutely love. I think that's the Coen's masterpiece. Everybody could talk about Fargo. I love Big Lebowski as well. I mean, that's right up there. But
And you're right about the sound design, just really quick on No Country for Old Men, because that is so upping the tension. I mean, just tenfold throughout. And even the last sound you hear is the ticking clock.
Yeah.
At the end. And what I thought was interesting is if you see the HBO, I love this, the HBO film, The Sunset Limited, which was based on a Cormac McCarthy play with Tommy Lee Jones as well. The last sound you hear in that is a ticking clock, too. So there was an interesting kind of ties between those two.
Yeah, I mean, when I interviewed Josh Brolin for that, and about that. He was like, I remember him sort of just rubbing his fingers together, and even just that of what he did. You know, you can hear that, and it's like just like using it like this, the rustling of fingers against skin or this and that. And I think that it certainly goes with what that natural look that Deakins certainly filmed. And, I mean, like I said, I think, can he direct? I think he can. I think he's worked with enough people. I mean,
yes, absolutely.
If anything, he could easily contact the Coens or anybody. I mean, I should also mention, too, on WALL-E. You know, you look
at
the
time. That's right. He was a visual consultant.
He was a consultant to make sure that I remember one colleague of ours said that when he was talking about, because he loved WALL-E. I think you named it the best.
It was one of the best films of its year. Definitely.
What he ended up saying, he goes, they didn't have to contact Roger Deakins to make sure that the camera work on an animated feature looked as fantastic as in a live action movie, but they did, and that's something that I ended up, you know, you know, I'm like, yeah, that just shows how, I mean, if they can go to him just as a consultant on anything visually, that's a testament to what that guy is capable of. And I mean...
And no Pixar film has topped WALL-E since then, in my opinion. I don't think there's anything that's quite gotten there.
I'm not as big on WALL-E. I think it's a very, 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 very good movie. Yeah. I just don't find it to be great. I think there is a certain preachiness to it. But the visual aspect on it, of course, with it being Pixar, it's always going to look good. But
I will agree, the strongest part of the film is the opening act. And I think that's when the visuals really tell the story. It's before any dialogue really comes in. And you can, I mean, if you look at any shot in the opening of that and then look at any other Deakins work, you can see his voice.
Yeah,
there,
I think, and you were saying it adds to the character and the story and everything, and that's certainly what Deakins does in Skyfall and in any other movie that he has already worked on, and I'm certainly on anything he is soon to come, and I hope he's got more. I hope he directs, and I hope he gets an Oscar nomination for Skyfall.
I agree.
I think it's worthy of it.
Yes, we're in agreement on that. Yeah. Definitely hope that happens. So thank you so much, Matt, for coming here today. Really appreciate it. It was a pleasure. And for all of your reviews, you can check out HollywoodSnitch.com. That's the place to find it, right?
Yes. We're on Twitter as well. Got a Facebook page. All you got to do is at HollywoodSnitch and Facebook.com/HollywoodSnitch. We're not that big, but we certainly like to we're adding a couple writers. I'm getting a little help sort of running it. Yeah, check us out and check out Matt as well.
Awesome. Yeah, that's great. Thank you. Yeah, and it's a great site. People should definitely check out Hollywood Snitch. And for all my recent reviews and interviews, you can check out HollywoodChicago.com and Indie-Outlook.com. That concludes today's episode of Indie Outlook. I'm your host, Matt Fagerholm, and I invite you to tune in next time for more coverage of the latest and greatest in modern independent cinema. Till then, I'll be on the lookout.